of harboring some terrorist elements. But sometimes the U.S. Would assist Pakistan militarily. Now, when the U.S. is not in a better relation with Pakistan for a stretch of time, China, of course, sees that opportunity and, try to fill in the gap. And, for example, this China-Pakistan economic corridor, because it could potentially benefit Pakistan a lot. So the China-Pakistan relationship sometimes becomes quite warm, as with now. Then, of course, the U.S. is not quite happy about that.
Sir, so do you think the unease in Washington is due to China and Russia emerging as new power centers amid the changing world order and also the success of China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, the problem with recent U.S. Foreign policy, it's sometimes it is very heavy on the rhetoric, but not so heavy on the action part. For example, China with its Belt and Road Initiative, they would, roll out a lot of trading relationship, a lot of investments, for example, in countries like Pakistan. The U.S., on the other hand, for example, sometimes they will condemn some activities by Pakistan. Sometimes they promise certain aids to Pakistan, but very often these sort of aids are not actually delivered. So, you know, from Pakistani point of view, and indeed from the point of view of many developing countries, well, the U.S. Doesn't seem to so-called walk its talk, whereas China, typically, they were bringing a lot of investments to these countries. Thereby, I think it is almost inevitable that a lot of these developing countries would find themselves more and more friendly with China and perhaps distancing themselves a little bit from the United States.
So, sir, talking about the United States, it has used the International Monetary Fund as a tool to pressure Islamabad into towing its line. So the question is, should Pakistan be looking elsewhere for external financing?
Well, Pakistan's economy is, frankly speaking, not in the best shape. It has to get assistance from whichever source that it could get its hands on. That would include anything from IMF to hopefully a very generous China. And I think that's part of the reason why Prime Minister Sharif is going to China. He was looking for some delays in paying some of the debts owed to China, or hopefully to get some forgiveness of those debts. I think very often you'll find China to be more generous in doing so, especially to developing countries. On the other hand, IMF, it has a very rigid, very often Western-oriented standards, and it's very difficult for you not to pay back to IMF on time and so on. But if your country is simply not in a condition to do that, yeah, then you have to look for sources elsewhere.
Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Government of Pakistan in a tweet said, during his two-day visit to China last month, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed broad-based cooperation in economy and investment and exchanged views on regional and global developments. Researcher and writer Sartaj Khan cites a recent Pentagon report as stating that China ranks Pakistan as its only all-weather strategic partner and Russia as its only comprehensive strategic partner. Chinese embassy in Pakistan in a tweet appreciates Islamabad's efforts in making China-Pakistan relations the cornerstone of its foreign policy, adding that the two sides will strengthen communication and cooperation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Last month, Nepal held elections for the parliament as well as for the provinces, the second vote since the country's constitution was promulgated in 2015. The final result is expected next week, but it appears that no political party will gain the majority in the 275-member house. Odds are in favor of the Nepali Congress-led alliance, which is good news for India. Importantly, the landlocked country situated in the Himalayas has in recent years been the battleground for regional supremacy between New Delhi and Beijing.
The general election in Nepal is being keenly followed by both India and China, the two regional powers. The Himalayan country has, under Prime Minister Sher Bahadur Deoba, shifted more towards New Delhi, sparking concern in Beijing. Thus, from India's perspective, the Deboa-led government is the best possible scenario. The five-party alliance comprises the Nepali Congress led by Deoba, the Communist Party of Nepal Maoist Center, the Communist Party of Nepal Unified Socialist, the Loktantrik Samajwadi Party, and the Rashtriya Janamorcha. Chinese strategists won't be happy with the possible election outcome, considering Beijing's foray into influencing the country's power politics. Over the past decade, the Chinese embassy in Kathmandu played an instrumental role in the merger of Nepal's two frontline communist parties into a single entity, the Nepal Communist Party, which paved the way for the thumping win of the alliance in the 2017 election. China's influence on the communist parties even prompted some to ask whether Beijing was micromanaging the country's power politics. Political pundits say the India-China rivalry to gain leverage in the landlocked country is set to enter a fresh phase when a new government takes charge in Kathmandu. A new turf is ready for the two powers.
The ruling Nepali Congress enjoys deep-rooted ties to India. After Sher Bahadur Deoba succeeded KP Sharma Oli as the country's prime minister in 2021, relations between the two countries not only improved but gained fresh momentum. China and India aren't the only countries with an eye on the Nepal elections. The United States, which has a fierce rivalry with China, is also following the political upheaval. A key strategic ally of New Delhi, Washington seeks to undermine China's Belt and Road Initiative and its Indo-Pacific influence.
After succeeding former Prime Minister Oli, the leader of the Communist Party of Nepal, in what was described as a Game of Thrones in 2021, Deoba embarked on his first visit to India in April 2021. The three-day visit helped resurrect a relationship that had been in the doldrums under the China-backed government in Kathmandu. Even before Oli began his first of the three fleeting terms in October 2015, India and Nepal were at odds over the new constitution that apparently did not include the marginalization concerns of two ethnic groups that live in the region bordering India and constitute 40% of Nepal's population. When Oli was removed from power in his first term, he blamed New Delhi. In 2018, he staged a comeback due to the unification of the communist factions, in which China played a key role. In the second term, India-Nepal relations virtually broke down over the map controversy. With pro-India Deoba in the driver's seat now, the mood in New Delhi is upbeat. The Indo-Pacific policymakers in Washington are also in a celebratory mood, as it will help them further undermine China's Belt and Road Initiative, of which Nepal forms a vital cog.
Now to talk more on this, we will also be joined by Mr. Goldoni, an analyst and commentator from Hong Kong. But before that, let's continue with Mr. A Sun Ho, who has kindly stayed with us. Now, sir, talking about the Nepal elections, a five-party political alliance led by Prime Minister Sher Bahadur Deoba is set to form the new government in Nepal despite the hung parliament. Is that good news for India?
Well, Nepal is a country which situates itself between India and China. And therefore, when these two big regional powers are not quite friendly with each other, then Nepal, it's very often squeezed in between. And Nepalese politics in recent years have been a contest between China on the one hand and India on the other hand in terms of influencing which parties or which politicians would come to power. Duba is, of course, widely perceived to be more pro-India as opposed to his predecessor, Mr. Oli. And therefore, if Duba were to form the new government, it would, at least for the moment, be seen to be more favorable to India. But of course, because this is, in a sense, a coalition government, and it may not be as stable as if Duba were forming the government only with his party. So I think what we could see now, it's only India has a temporary upper hand at the moment here.
Now, for the next question, I would like to welcome Mr. Goldoni to the program. Mr. Goldoni, the landlocked country has moved towards India since Duba took office in 2021, antagonizing China. But can the new government afford to ignore Beijing amid shifting geopolitical dynamics?
I can say that the coalition that has got in power in 2021 has started to move and shift its attention, let's say, from China more to India. I believe that in a country where the economic, the GDP is not very high, is quite small actually. We are talking about $45 billion. It's very important to have an economy that is open to the most important driving source of growth in Asia. It means China, definitely. And, of course, also India. So I see this one, reorganizing of a priority, a little bit risky for a country as Nepal, as you said, is landlocked, where they have a huge border with Tibet. So I really think that they should be more careful in rearranging the priorities. Now in this case, I'm talking about economic priorities, and it's quite clear that this priority has been most probably imposed by external means, by external actor.
Back to Mr. Ason Oh again. Sir, why is India so important for Nepal and vice versa in terms of strategic and economic interests?
Well, in a sense, India shares more culturally with Nepal. A number of India's major religions originated from Nepal, such as Buddhism and so on. So traditionally, India would consider Nepal to be one of its, in a sense, a protectorate, even though officially they could not call so. But of course, in recent years, as China's economic muscles grow, it also tried to dabble its hands in terms of growing its influence in Nepal. So that's why you have this, in a sense, tug of war between two regional powers, which manifests itself in the politics of Nepal. Sometimes you would see Nepalese leaders who are more pro-China and sometimes more pro-India. But the traditional leanings of Nepal was indeed with India. It's just that, frankly speaking, India perhaps is not in a position to assist Nepal economically to a large extent. And that's why China could play its important role.
Last but not least, to finish this off, let's go back to Mr. Goldoni. Sir, do you think the United States will step up its Indo-Pacific interventionist games in order to undermine its chief adversary, China, under the Duba government?
I believe that Nepal is a very important geopolitical strategic position, very, very important. Several reasons. One is regarding the borders, no? Because if we have seen recently, let's say in the last 1 year, where the most friction we have between India and China, all the friction was around the borders from the north of India, and then even to Bhutan. And definitely, because the border with Nepal and Tibet is so long, it will be strategic to try to influence and to control this country. But I will add one more reason why is important. My analysis is the reason is important because the United States are trying to give something to India in order to bring the position to India more close to the United States, especially in confronting the two main problems, the geopolitical problem that now they have. It means Russia and China. And in the past, that India is not so much, as I can say, willing to take part, no, from in this to let's say conflict, potential conflict, but Nepal could be a kind of candies, a kind of pawn that is you know, given to India in order to, you know, give something and try to you know, to bring India on the political side of the United States. I see this one in this point, you know, yeah.
On that note, I would like to thank both our guests, Mr. Aysun Oh from Kuala Lumpur and Mr. Fabrizio Goldoni from Hong Kong, for being on the program, and thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nepal-based journalist Santosh Gimir says the results of country's general elections are yet to emerge, but it is likely that the dice is loaded in favor of the Nepali Congress-led alliance that is considered close to India. Anil Sigdale, a policy analyst and author, notes the emergence of a new equation in Nepali politics, especially one that carries an anti-American tone, which he says will continue to test American diplomacy in Nepal. Nepal-based academic Upendra Gautam points to foreign interference in Nepal after the general elections, citing reports saying that Indian diplomats are engaged in talks with politicians in the power corridors.
And that was our episode about Pakistan's growing strategic partnership with China and how it's giving jitters to hawks in Washington. And also, Nepal's general election being the good news for India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. The revolution triumphed despite immeasurable discord triggered by international writers and orators in the media and through speeches. The most was the condition of the universities, high schools, and educational centers on which the future of the country depends. These centers employed teachers and professors who were fascinated with the West or the East and were absolutely opposed to Islamic culture and to patriarch values. Among these teachers and professors were, of course, some committed and considerate ones.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, you are listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. I am Zainab Mousavi, and in this program, we try to talk and discuss different viewpoints of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, about modern and classic subjects even, and take those precious words and sentences of him into more thinking and contemplation. Well, on the subject of knowledge and the knowledgeable, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, says that the language of the Quran has great praise for knowledge, which is accompanied by piety. This sentence signifies the great emphasis of Islam and consequently Quran on knowledge and learning. There are several verses in Quran in praise of knowledge as well. And the reason for such a great emphasis is the fact that the more a person learns knowledge and gains comprehension, the better he or she would come to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the magnitude of this fact is so much that the very first verse descended on the Holy Prophet is about learning to read and write. And now I'm talking about the first verse of Surah Al-Alaq, اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق, or read in the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who created you. And there are numerous other verses in praise of those who know and setting them apart and different from those who don't know. The examples are the 39th verse of Surah Al-Zumar, هل يستوي الذين يعلمون والذين لا يعلمون. Are they equal, those who know and those who don't know? Or another verse, the 28th verse of Surah Al-Fatir, إِنَّمَا يَخْشَى اللَّهُ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ الْعُلَمَاءُ. Only those knowledgeable servants of God are afraid of Him.
يَا رَبَّنَا صَلِّ عَلَى طَاهَ النَّبِيِّ وَآلِهِ
You know, the point that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is making is that the praised knowledge from the viewpoints of Quran is knowledge accompanied by piety, which means that it must lead to a positive change within somebody's soul. Knowledge in its true and mere sense is good, but when it is put into action, it would be praiseworthy and precious. Well, it seems that the time of this episode has come to its end. Let's just close the program with reading this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah again. In regard to knowledge and the knowledgeable, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh says that the language of the Quran has great praise for knowledge, which is accompanied by piety. Thank you for listening to us. Hope you all to have a nice day. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wa ma ana bitaridil mu'minin.
And I am not one to drive away the believers.
إن أنا إلا نذير مبين.
I am only a clear warner.
Dear listeners, as you were with us in the previous programs, you know we have reached the 114th verse of chapter Shu'ara. The verse reads, وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ, and the 115th one, إِنْ أَنَا إِلَّا نَذِيرٌ مُبِينٌ. The 114th verse said, وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ means, I am not going to drive away the believers. إِنْ أَنَا إِلَّا نَذِيرٌ مُبِينٌ, I am not but a plain warner. As we concluded in the previous episode, for judging about others, the present sincere faith and righteous deeds of them should be dealt with. We are not to look at their past and what they used to do in the past. The past actions of the persons must not be shown to them. And it is the Prophet's mission to improve people and to invite them to monotheism. They are not responsible for the deeds of the individuals, and specifically the deeds of the pasts before they joined the troops of the and before they became the followers of the Prophet. That is why the previous verse said, "In hisabuhum illa ala Rabbi." Their reckoning is only on my Lord. I do not care about that. So, in this verse, Prophet Noah implies that his duty is to be humble for all classes of the seekers of truth. The criterion is only to seek the truth, to believe, and that criterion is enough. The verse says, وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ I'm not going to drive away the believers. This statement is, in fact, an answer to the implicit demand of those wealthy, proud people who had demanded Prophet to repel and send away those poor people so that they could approach him. But Prophet Noah implicitly says that his only duty is to warn people. In أَنَا إِلَّا نَذِيرٌ مُبِينٌ I am not but a plain warner.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So when the people tried to make Prophet drive away the poor believers, he said, it is my duty to warn people, and if they had done something in the past, it's not my duty to care about it. In hisabuhum illa ala Rabbi, and in ana illa nadhirun mubin. I am nothing but a plain warner. He who hears this warning of Noah's and turns back from the deviated path into the straight path is his follower, whoever he is, and in whatever condition of finance and social conditions he might be. It is noteworthy that not only Noah, who was an ark prophet, was found fault with this objection, but also the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, who is the seal of the prophets, as well as the other prophets, were found this fault. But the answer Prophet Noah gives these pagans is decisive one. وَمَا أَنَا بِطَارِدِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ I am not going to drive away some poor believers only to try to attract you as wealthy ones so that you might be even closer to me, so that you might approach me and join the believers. But for joining more believers, I'm not going to drive away the poor ones. The criterion is the same for all. Believers, al-mu'mineen, the believers. The attraction must be at its highest levels, but to repel the people, but to drive away the people, must be at its lower level. And the best way to interact with some of the pagans bringing false excuses is to warn them of the danger they're putting themselves in. I am not but a plain warner. In an illa nadhirun mubin. The word bashir, which is of course one of the other aspects of prophethood, is not mentioned here, which means that for these excuses, only warning is the thing that works and applies. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Economic divide.
In early 2022, FTX, a crypto exchange, was valued at $32 billion and a household name. It took fewer than 8 days for Sam Bankman-Fried to go from being nicknamed the King of Crypto to his company filing for bankruptcy. Now there are speculations of not only money laundering, but the failed crypto exchange took in millions in donations for Ukraine, but allegedly rerouting the sums back to U.S. politicians. Conspiracy theory? That's what we want to find out in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, the FTX fall, money laundering operation, millions in donations for Ukraine, crypto donations went to Kiev's war effort. That's what was reported. Next, crypto's destination. Now, it's supposed to go to Ukraine's national bank, but some of that went to U.S. political donations. The FTX CEO donated roughly $38 million, maybe a little bit more, to the Democratic Party. And then we will take a look at FTX regulation scheme. That's right, this thing is pretty widespread, where FTX spent millions lobbying to shape crypto regulations. Now keep in mind, Democrats are responsible for overseeing the Trade Commission.
Since the war in Ukraine began in February 2022, Western nations and their politicians and billionaires began to rally behind Kiev. Apart from weapons, they began to offer donations to officials in Kiev to keep the government functioning. But it has now turned out that some of those donations were not so innocent. Notorious cryptocurrency exchange FTX and its founder Samuel Bankman-Fried has filed for bankruptcy. Its company was once valued at $32 billion, and its owner had a net worth estimated at more than $15 billion as of late October. His company began to fall apart last month. It has now emerged that his company functioned as the central clearinghouse for all crypto donations to Kiev's war effort.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that gets to the point that this can be a great thing for the world. I think it can also be a really messy thing, but I think that at its core, you know, we've seen millions of dollars go through, the systems we've given. I think something close to a million ourselves as well, to support, humanitarian aid and growth in Ukraine. And I think when you think about what it would take to get, to get funds both to the government there, where we do have a relationship with the Ukrainian government for raising capital for them using cryptocurrencies.
Money sent to Ukraine by Democratic politicians in the U.S. would see their money come back in the form of donations through FTX. In more simple terms, the company was transferring money to Ukraine and then laundering money back from Ukraine to the Democratic Party. As an example, other parties, such as the Republicans, were also noted in this.
All right, time to find out what is being posted on this. As we speak, there's been a social media storm on FTX and its bankruptcy. So let's get going. First up, like we have been saying for months, the Ukraine war is nothing but a money laundering scheme funded by U.S. taxpayers. This particular view obviously seems to hit it right on. Next, how else are they supposed to get U.S. tax money back into their pockets? That's what we've been saying in this program, and we would elaborate more on that a little later. Next post, well, they would be absolutely spot on. It's a proxy war, with the only winner being the military-industrial complex. They are earning a fortune of our taxpayers' money and giving massive donations to the Democrats, DNC, through FTX and others. Next, great question, is Washington still our ally? EU accusing U.S. of profiteering from Ukraine war through sales of guns and gas and threatening trade war, as top diplomats moan Biden's green subsidies means European businesses are relocating to the U.S. What we did was we further expanded on this. As soon as the Ukraine war started, President Zelensky partnered with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried for crypto donations. It posed this question: is this greed or is this corruption? Well, let's take a look at this a little bit further in terms of this partnering with FTX. Everstake to launch new crypto donation website. FTX is converting crypto contributions to Ukraine's war effort into fiat for deposit at the National Bank of Ukraine. The Ukrainian government launched a new crypto donations website, streamlining its multi-million dollar effort to turn Bitcoin into bullets, bandages, and other war material. Aid for Ukraine, which has the backing of crypto exchange FTX, staking platform Everstake, and Ukraine's Kuna exchange, will route donated crypto to the National Bank of Ukraine. The country's collective efforts have already raised some $48 million in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Other estimates are placing that amount closer to $100 million. All right, so those posts we picked because they kind of fall in line in terms of some of the things that we're assuming at this point about this fallout from FTX and, of course, the different connections it has from money laundering to U.S. political systems. But let's find out what our guests think about this. First up is Vijay Varghese. Now, he's a managing partner at Amparo & Company. It's a global liquidity provider and also market for precious metals, market maker, that is, for precious metals and digital assets. Vijay Varghese, welcome to Economic Divide. FTX was valued at $32 billion. It was a household name. And then you have this Sam Bankman-Fried becoming an official billionaire, thanks to, obviously, his secondary and more high-profile business, which was FTX. Now, the crypto exchange grew to be the second largest in the world. He was estimated to be worth $16.7 billion. But in 8 days, the firm collapsed. How could that happen in such a short amount of time?
The way it happens is this. The way FTX was structured, the way it was built, it was designed by its own inception to be something other than a quote-unquote crypto exchange. Its setup is very similar to what you find not in a stock exchange or a stock market or an actual physical crypto exchange, but something you'd see similar to an Enron. In fact, when experts have taken apart FTX's corporate layout, they've seen over 70 plus entities that we know of, and possibly even more that was within its corporate structure. And you only get a structure like that if your whole design was to money launder. Your whole design was to move money, steal funds, mix funds. Nothing good comes out of a structure like that. That's number one. And number two, a 28-year-old kid out of college, there's no way in hell a kid like that could come up with a structure like that. This was created for him. FTX is a creation of very, very nefarious private interests that are right here in the United States.
All right. Thank you for that. We're going to throw that point to our next guest and see what he thinks. Craig Holman is serves as Public Citizens. He's a Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. And also he's an expert on campaign finance. Craig Holman, welcome to Economic Divide. All right. Now, there are charges against FTX when it comes to the failed crypto exchange that it was a money laundering operation. It took in millions of dollars, if not more, in donations for Ukraine, but allegedly it rerouted some of these sums back to U.S. politicians. That's a very severe charge. Now, in terms of the Democratic Party, the second largest donor was Sam Bankman-Fried, pouring in some roughly about $40 million into Canada's coffers in 2022 alone. Do you see that? Do you agree with that?
Well, one part of that story is true. I mean, Bankman had laundered actually even more. Personally, he gave about $40 million to Democratic lawmakers to try to avoid regulation of the industry. And then his co-conspirator, Ryan Salami, gave about $23 million in campaign contributions to Republican lawmakers. All in all, the cryptocurrency industry has, in just the last 2 years, has literally increased their amount of campaign contributions to American lawmakers by almost fivefold, you know, and that was all designed to try to prevent Congress from coming out with a strong regulatory scheme.
The InfoNews section of the program is here. That's where we take a look at some other news from around the world with an economic flavor. First up, we're going to take a look at what's called bypassing SWIFT. SWIFT is a financial system in which Russia and China have plans to bypass it. Now, these trading partners have been boosting transactions in national currencies. We've been telling you about that all along here at Economic Divide, pretty much. The Russian Deputy Prime Minister actually has said, quote, in gas contracts, we are already switching to settlements in national currencies. So there you have that aspect of it. Which is happening in rubles and in yuan, Russian ruble and then the Chinese yuan, and that's happening on a parity basis. He then added supplies of oil and oil products, as well as coal, are also being switched to payments in national currencies. Just a side note here, Russian price cap on its oil was actually approved by the EU, something that Russia has outright denied, so we have to wait and see how that's going to affect the way that transactions are happening when it comes to Russian oil. All right, next up, we're going to take a look at protests that are happening at Amazon. You've heard of Amazon, I'm sure. They have staged walkouts, and this came on Black Friday, in which it was called Black Friday Employees. And what they did, these protests happened across the globe, and they demanded Amazon to naturally pay better wages and to improve their working conditions. This has been going on for quite some time, actually. Now, these protests happened from Germany and France to the U.S., from India to Japan and the United Kingdom. Shows how vast it is, where Amazon's employees downed their tools and joined marches for that Black Friday. All right, EU gas purchases. I just mentioned the EU. And so in terms of insider EU gas purchases, the European Union has spent actually $13 billion on Russian LNG this year. Go figure. How is that possible if they're being actually sanctioned? Now, that's five times more than in 2021, in which the highest demand came from Belgium and from France. Now, the surge in LNG imports this year shows the difficulty in punishing Russia for its special military operation in Ukraine. I wonder if Belgium and France actually knew that there was going to be a cap on the Russian oil, and they were the ones who actually have spent the most buying it. Anyways, taking a look at this particular piece of news, this is very important in terms of a split between the U.S. and France. The French president has warned that subsidies paid to U.S. companies under a vast green energy plan may split the West as a whole. He further added that U.S. industrial subsidies are, quote, super aggressive against French and European competitors. Trade tensions clouded his high-profile state visit to the U.S., which he paid a visit to the U.S. just very recently.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
We've reached a segment to the program called the In-Depth Section, where we will look at the relationship between FTX, Ukraine, the United States, and in particular, the Democratic Party, and in turn, FTX contributions. Let's first look at the timeline of events that are important in maybe answering any ambiguities there. First, in September 2021, Ukraine formally legalized crypto. Then comes February 2022. Russia's special military operation in Ukraine began. And then we're taking a look at February 26. Kuna, which is Ukraine's largest crypto exchange, receives crypto for the war in the same month. Now, this crypto exchange is what it received was called a war effort donation. Next up, we take a look at a month later from that date, in March, Kuna's collaboration with FTX began. It said that it worked with the FTX to convert cryptocurrency donations into Ukraine's government-issued currency. Now, as to the amount of the money that flowed in, officially, this is what was reported, close to $100 million in crypto donations. Now, the crypto fund for Ukraine, run by Michael Chobanyan, he's the founder of the Ukrainian crypto exchange Kuna, accounted for 60% of all the donations. In case you were wondering why crypto, because crypto donations allowed Kyiv to obtain funding instantly, and then deposited them in the National Bank of Ukraine. Now, FTX's connection to the U.S. political parties. FTX's CEO, Bankman-Fried, has become a major Democratic donor. FEC records showed that he made significant donations to Democratic candidates and PACs, including a $27 million donation to the Protect Our Future PAC, which supports mostly Democratic candidates. However, he has also made contributions to some Republican candidates. Now, maybe this diagram can put things into perspective, titled U.S. Tax Dollars at Work. Money came from FTX in the form of donations to the Democratic Party and PACs. The party itself will then obviously back Biden. Then Biden gives the U.S. tax dollars in the form of military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Then Ukraine uses the U.S. aid to partner with FTX. Now, the parts that's most concerning, all of them, frankly, but the U.S. military and humanitarian assistance. The U.S. has given billions of dollars to Ukraine. Don't forget that. And then finally, when it came to the 2022 U.S. midterms, let's take a look at who were the largest donors. Now, in this case, since our focus is on Sam Bankman-Friedman, he was the number two donor. You can see over here, George Soros came in at number one at $129 million. All right, in case you didn't get that flowchart or anything that we just talked about, let me reintroduce our guest. Vijay Varghese, managing partner at Empower & Company, rejoins us to tell us what he can. Well, a question to you. First of all, welcome back. A question to you, Vijay, is the news that Ukraine accepted donations towards its military defense against Russia via digital currencies. The first question that comes to mind is, why is it accepting digital currencies in the first place? I mean, if you want to take a look at the amount of money that the U.S. is contributing to this war, it's billions of dollars. And maybe that is one of the reasons. What do you think? What is the reason for that?
Oh, yeah. It's a great question. And I'll tell you right now, if this was simply a war of attrition with Russia, and part of it is, okay, there's many layers to this whole Ukraine thing. But when you just look at why, just the question is why digital currency payments were used in Ukraine right at the same time where the U.S. is sending billions of dollars to Ukraine, and then all of a sudden, left and right, many, many brand-new Ukrainian exchanges, cryptocurrency exchanges were popping up, the answer is really simple. If you want a fast and efficient way to covertly fund various groups that are in Ukraine, and we know that the Azov Brigade, the Banderistas, the Stepan Bandera, those who follow this Nazi ideology that's so prevalent within the Ukrainian power structure, if you want to fund some of those people of the most ill repute, this is a great way to do it. It allows you to fund very quickly. It allows you to get your money, get your capital into whatever dark, nefarious project you want to get into, whatever missions you want to run. And then it also, what it also does, it covers you from any sort of congressional oversight.
I think the key word there, the phrase, was congressional oversight that our guest Vijay said there. Let's see what Craig Holman thinks. He serves as a public citizen's Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. Craig, welcome back. You know, this deal with the cryptocurrencies being accepted from Ukraine, coming through anonymous donors, really, is something that is very much under question here in terms of what I'm asking you, because we don't quite understand why that is. Why is Ukraine receiving it via cryptocurrency? Why is the U.S. Actually okay with sending it that way when it's billions of dollars that we're talking about here?
Well, you know, I am not a believer in the whole cryptocurrency industry, so I would advise everyone to stay away from cryptocurrency. But what was going on, there was a cryptocurrency startup company in Ukraine called Everstake. And it was their idea to try to pull in some more money from foreign sources to help pay for the war effort. And they did pull in roughly about $60 million, according to records, to pay for the war effort. So they were just trying to come up with other means of getting investments that they could use to buy helmets and other things to, you know, to help defend themselves against Russia.
In March, the FTX launched crypto donation platform Aid for Ukraine. Practically, it set itself up as a central clearinghouse for all cryptocurrency donations to Kiev, but the company funneled at least some of that money back to the U.S. through political donations. Bankman-Fried was once one of the most important donors to the Democratic Party for the midterm elections. He poured nearly $38 million into candidates' campaigns in 2022.
Oh, yes. Her staffers have been talking to a lot of folks in the industry, trying to figure out what was really going on. And in fact, actually, one of them was very, very interested in the question, how did FTX get so big so fast? And those of us in the industry who were watching what was going on and frankly were appalled by some of the behavior that was taking place there, we knew what was going on. And again, a lot of this has already been reported to law enforcement and it's starting to come out. And I expect there will be more that does come out. So, yes, they've been watching this, and they've been on to the right questions, I think. And let's see now whether there's follow-through in Washington. At this point, who knows?
In March of this year, the government of Ukraine passed a law that creates a legal framework for the cryptocurrency industry in the country. It allowed banks to open accounts for crypto companies. According to reports, the Ukrainian government had already received over $60 million in crypto donations as of March. That money has not been updated since then, and there are no reliable information about the exact amount of money Kiev has received in cryptocurrency. But the reasons for Ukraine's push towards cryptocurrency were under question, especially at a time when Kiev is already receiving huge sums of money from Western nations. Ukrainian officials have not provided any detailed and reliable reports on spending. Ukraine is said to have spent 75% of the money it raised through cryptocurrencies, but what happened to the remaining funds cannot be unambiguously explained. Critics say the lack of full-fledged reporting has cast doubts on the proper use of the service.
Bitcoin's use in military operations has been on the rise since the Ukrainian army received Bitcoin donations. According to new statistics from blockchain analytics startup Elliptic, within a 12-hour period, there was approximately $400,000 in Bitcoin contributed to Come Back Alive, a Ukrainian nonprofit group that supports the armed forces. Elliptic reported that the crypto donations reached hundreds of thousands of dollars and has been poured into Ukrainian NGOs and volunteer organizations attempting to counter Russian